This recording is a production of Faith Builders. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2013, held at Faith Builders on August 6th through 9.
Make sure everyone has one. Welcome to this workshop on the trouble with facts. I remember being impressed, interested, knocked sideways by a saying I heard here one time in which the person said, "Know your stuff. Who you're stuffing, and gently stuff them." But what stuff? Which stuff? What are you going to do with it? Our world today, I think more than ever before, is overflowing with facts. Teachers are awash in facts. Students are drowning in facts. No one could possibly absorb all of the facts, and most of the facts really aren't worth absorbing. Furthermore, is a full student a good student? Will being full of facts make you ready for life? While facts are an important part of school life, there's some problems with facts, and that's what we're here to analyze and think about today. First, difficulty. There are way too many facts. There are billions of facts. I thought, I wonder what would happen if I typed fact into Google. In today's world, Google is a noun and a verb, isn't it? So I typed in fact, and it came up with 941 million hits, approximately. Shall we know them all? I have here a little clip out of one page of a student text. Now, those of you who recognize this text, this is God's Orderly World, Book 1, from Rodden Staff, targeting maybe the junior high school level, and it's a pretty fact-dense book, but our textbooks tend to be fact-dense. I've only selected a little more, well, actually, a part of a paragraph and the first line of the next, a tiny little piece of this page. And I thought, well, let's just see what students are faced with when it comes to facts, not using Google or the internet, but just looking at the textbooks that they deal with. What do they see? And so I said, well, I'll just take this little clip and maybe we can analyze it. And let's just look at the page and let's think, what are facts? Let's pick out the facts, right? So what are the what items on this page are facts? So I got to looking at it and I said, well, here's just the end of a sentence. Immunity is called vaccination. I said, that's a fact. They even italicize that word, so that's important. Students, remember that for the test. Immunity is called vaccination. So the very first word on the page is part of a fact. So then I said, well, what's next? So I looked at it, and there's another sentence, and it's a fact. The inoculating material is called vaccine. Shall I put that in the quiz tomorrow, or shall I use it in the test? Said it's a fact. Okay, so let's go on. For years, many children were required to have smallpox vaccination before entering the first grade of school. Is that a fact?
Yes.
Okay, so underline that. What's next? The vaccination for smallpox has been so successful that the disease has apparently been destroyed from the earth. Is that a fact? All right, underline that, students. Okay. Maybe you're beginning to get the idea, because if you can read down the rest of it for yourself, but it's actually all facts. Every single sentence in here is a fact. And you can read the rest of the page and you'll come into the same problem. So, what's the solution? Students, I've been looking at your science text. And the more I look at it, the more I realize it is full of facts. So what we're going to do this year is we're going to memorize the science text. you can't cover all the facts. There's just too many facts. There's no way you can cover all the facts. Even if you could memorize your science text, this is only science. What happens when you get into the other subjects that you're studying? So the question comes, if they can't learn all the facts, then what do I do? Well, I think any teacher knows already that you need to select and emphasize the facts that are most important. And if you know anything about textbook compilation and publishing, you realize that the writers go through that same process. They have stacks of information. Sometimes students complain about something like a history text. Wow, all it is a whole bunch of dates and facts. Well, why? Because it's an incredibly condensed version of the available material. And these textbook authors agonize over which facts they'll have to cut. Do we have the bare minimum of important facts? And you pick up that textbook and you got to cut again. So what facts are most important? And as teachers, we love facts and we like to drill facts. So suppose you come across something like this in English. Which fact is important for the student to know? There are 6 common coordinating conjunctions. Students, repeat that after me. Or a few of the coordinating conjunctions are and, but, or, nor, for, yet. Some teachers do not get the difference between those two. And you can have your students doing a lot of memorization and quizzes on things that are not important. Does it make any difference to anybody whether there are 6 common coordinating conjunctions? And after your students have it all memorized, you'll find out, if you're an astute teacher, it's not even true. There are more than 6. So we really need to focus on that. But I'm going to move on. There are more problems with facts. Facts are not always facts. And maybe in a way, this will help us to sort out in the whole context of facts what to deem important and what to deem less important. But there is something here that came as an incredible surprise to me in some of my earlier years of teaching. I was fully aware of the fact that you have to sort through and you can't cover all the facts. But when I came across this one, it took me by surprise. Facts are not always facts, even in textbooks. So what are the problems? Well, I have here on your handout the subpoints I'm going to cover here. And the first one is that facts, quotation marks right there, facts change. And here's what opened my eyes. Here's what shocked me. I don't know if any of you are familiar with this or not. This is a chart in the Abeka 6th grade science book, copyright 1991, which is that particular edition. It's actually changed since then, but this is the one I was teaching out of. And it's a beautiful chart. I mean, look at those planets and distant galaxies. It's fun to look at, and it's got all the information carefully collated there. And I was going over this chart with my students, and we had already memorized the planets. I counted that as important facts. Now, those of you who are teaching in more modern times realize we already have an argument over what's a planet and whether it gets to be called a planet or not. But this was in the old days. They have Pluto up there on their planet list. So we had already memorized the planets, nice little simple list there. And now we're going down through, and I was asking them questions from the chart. And it was, how many moons does Jupiter have? Well, it's easy to find right there. In parentheses, it says Jupiter, 16 moons. And how many moons for Saturn, 18. And so we were thinking about how many moons each of the planets have. And we were doing a little back and forth. And one of the students who was particularly perceptive said, that can't be right. And I said, well, why not? It says it right there, Jupiter, 16 moons. And he said, you have a chart on the wall about the planets, and it says Jupiter 38 moons, something like that. And I was like, what? So we went over and looked at the chart, and sure enough, it was true. Well, I didn't know much of anything about planetary moons. I was just going by the textbook. So I said, okay, we're going to find out. So I looked it up. And if I recall correctly, it was actually Jupiter 65 moons. So I said, well, there's a problem with this. What are the facts? So I got into a little research project on planetary moons. And I found out that astronomers have no idea how many moons the planets have. Every time they send out a new probe or an orbiter and they have increased their imaging capabilities, they find more moons. It's a work in progress. So as the space exploration continues, the number of moons continues to explode. And some of you are probably familiar with the fact that they are now counting up moons around distant stars and trying to decide on their size and number and so forth. So what I thought was a fact, and I was going to drill my students on, was not a fact and wasn't worth drilling. If you memorize that, you just memorized a pointless piece of outdated information. There is, unfortunately, a lot of things like that. Here's another example. I don't know how many of you keep up with science news, but you may have read some of the recent articles about the research on junk DNA. For years, scientists said that there are parts of the DNA code that clearly stack up information, and then there's a large part of the, what appears to be part of the DNA that doesn't do anything, and they're not sure why it's there. And they assume that it was just left over from our evolutionary past. Scientists recently were doing some more research, and they found out that actually what we have is kind of like a second class of DNA. These coders actually turn on and off certain parts of the DNA sequence and have control over what's going on. They are very fundamental, very important, and all of a sudden we have what used to be a nothing turned into a whole new field of research, and scientists today are saying, wow, we've just gotten started. It'll take us years to figure out what all this stuff does now that we know that it's actually functional. Well, one of the big kickbacks from that is that it used to be a popular saying that humans and chimpanzees have a 99% DNA structure. Now we find out that it's not even close. Well, it wasn't even close before, but I'm not going to go down that rabbit trail. Okay, maybe you drill geography names with your students. Maybe you're old enough to remember being drilled on Czechoslovakia. It's a nice name. All right, students, which country? Czechoslovakia. Well, you know that Czechoslovakia doesn't exist. Used to, doesn't anymore. It's been divided into the Czech Republic and Slovakia, separate, one that gained independence in 93. And we can fall into those things. And I think those types of things, well, here's another one, brain usage. Maybe you've heard that we only use 10% of our brains and 90% sits dormant there. Well, that was never true, and I'm not sure if anybody who knew anything about the brain ever really believed it to be true, but it has become a very popular supporting point in speaking to tell us either how stupid we are or how much capacity we have left that we're not using. But the fact of the matter is we use all of our brain. Every piece of our brain is used. There are some cells in our brain that serve as insulation around the nerve to keep it from shorting out. And then there's a lot of our brain that they weren't sure exactly what functionality it has, and now they realize that, yes, it's very important and very functional. So scientists today say, not true. Every part of our brain is used. And I have this article, Brain's Complexity is Beyond Anything Imagined. I think I listed some of these articles on the end of the handout. I'm not sure if I have that right with me here. Yes, I've got kind of a resources list. Fascinating here. New computer software processed all the data to produce stunning three-dimensional images of never-before-seen brain-cell connections. A study was published in the journal Neuron to showcase the usefulness of array tomography, but the technical paper also provided broad implications for neurobiology. Array tomography could resolve fine details at the level of synapses. And if you're not familiar with all these brain terminologies, what that is that you have the very end of the nerve cell and the very end of the other brain nerve cell. And as a matter of fact, there's a tiny gap between them, which is what regulates the flow of information. And it's kind of funny because if you grab something, then you have this feedback to your brain. As it goes through each neuron, each nerve, what happens is if there's enough electrical stimulation, it will release a few cells and they will cross that gap if there are enough of them, and they'll finally get over to this one, and then it will stimulate and pass along that nerve. So as long as the stimulation is big enough, it will keep going on. If the stimulation isn't big enough, it'll die out. So that fits in with your thought processes. If you have a partially formed thought, basically what you've got here is we've started crossing the synapses, but it just wasn't enough electrical information to make it on to the next one, and eventually you have this die out. So this is how it works. They have these little synapses, and they're incredibly tiny. But this new way of imaging, you can actually see what's happening in the microscopic cellular chemical level as it transfers information across there. The researchers found the brain's complexity is beyond anything they'd imagined. According to an article appearing in the health tech section of online news source CNET2, for instance, they found that the total number of synapses in a brain roughly equaled the number of stars in 1,500 Milky Way galaxies. And memory patterns and tiny on-off switches, which were long thought to reside in the larger neuron cell bodies, were instead found to be smaller than the tiny synapse connection. Each of the neurons imaged in the study serves thousands of synapses. Stanford University professor and senior study author Stephen Smith said that one synapse may contain on the order of 1,000 molecular scale switches. A single human brain has more switches than all the computers and routers and internet connections available on the Earth. This research multiplies the brain's overall computing power far beyond what was previously known. The more complicated a system is, the stronger it argues for having been intentionally designed, and he finishes up that article. But here you have, you're reading along, and you see, oh, this is a complete rebuttal to this idea I had embraced and maybe even reminded my students when they said their work was too hard that we only use 10% of our brain, right? So we have to be aware of the nature of facts as we use them. And I think that awareness will temper the way we teach our facts. And I think we need to have a certain humility as teachers. We love to just be the encyclopedia, right? It's kind of a love-hate relationship. People expect us to be encyclopedias, and we hate that because we don't always know what they ask us. But we love to be the encyclopedia because then when we have the answers and act like we know it all. But we need to have a sense of humility as we share these things with our students, saying, this is what I understand, this is what I know, this is what the textbook says, this is the extent of my knowledge, but this is how it fits into the broader picture, students. I'm not God. I don't know everything. And some of the things I tell you, you may find out are wrong. And that's perfectly fine. You see, sometimes a student comes up and says, well, I've been reading the encyclopedia, and what you shared in science class today isn't correct. And you say, sit down and be quiet. Well, you see, that is not the correct attitude for a teacher. The teacher's attitude is, wow, that's amazing. Let's look at it. You know, I need to learn things too. And so we have that problem. Secondly, under that, facts are often told out of context. And I don't really want to be a teacher basher today. I'm a teacher too, and I've made plenty of my own mistakes. So if it seems like I'm jumping up and down on your toes, it's not really intentional. It's just that somehow we seem to be specifically put in this groove in which we fall into these things. Facts are often told out of context, and teachers love stories. And I love stories too. The only problem is sometimes we're not thoughtful enough or intentional enough in the stories we tell. And in that way, we can slide. And textbook publishers fall into the same problem. One of the popular stories in American history is Columbus discovering America. It's so beautiful. We have a man in which all of his fellows believe that the earth was a pancake. And that if you sailed too far, you would fall off the edge into the abyss. And so this visionary man, a scientist really, thought the earth is a globe. And he discovered this by sitting on the shore and watching the ships come up, right? And so he said, if we sail far enough, we can get around. And he somehow found these sterling sailors who just were so bold and brave that they thought they would give this a try. So they got in their boats and they headed off across. And Columbus discovered America. Boys and girls, you're just stirred by that, right? I'm not against the beauty of the story, and I'm not against the personalization of history. History is very personal, and I think we should share those facets and those aspects. And connecting with our students on that level is good. But many of us who have told the story, and I have, are not aware that this account of history was developed by an author named Washington Irving. Who also wrote some other stories and is a very interesting author. Maybe you know The Legend of Sleepy Hollow or some of the Rip Van Winkle. I don't know. It's hard for me to trust him as a historian, but he was a very creative writer, and he wrote a lot of interesting tales. And they, of course, they were engaging, so they came into the minds of the populace, and from then on, we just carry these things with us. Well, so what's the truth here? What's going on? Well, Columbus did make a trip across, but I hardly know where to start. Maybe I'll start with this article. Ancient maps support biblical history. And when I came across this article, I was fascinated by it. I love this kind of stuff. It blows the history text apart. I apologize for that. But I enjoy this kind of information. In 1929, a discovery was made of a map made in 1513 by Piri Reis, an admiral in the Turkish Navy. In constructing his map, Reis referred to 20 earlier maps, one of which dated back to the 4th century BC. The Reis map shows the longitude between Africa and South America exactly as it is. Even though Europeans did not invent the instrument to measure longitude until the year 1765. The map also seems to indicate a portion of Antarctica without ice. Reis used plane geometry for his map, but experts can tell that at least one of the original maps was drawn using spherical trigonometry. Orontius Phineus drew a map in 1531 that must have been copied from maps made during a time when Earth's climate was very different. The Phineus map accurately shows Antarctica with the mountain ranges and rivers that are now covered by more than a mile of ice. According to modern interpretations of the Ice Age, Antarctica has been covered with ice for close to a million years. Some of these mountain ranges were not even discovered by Europeans until 1957. The existence of Antarctica was not verified until 1819. In addition to these maps are Chinese geography books dating to 2200 BC. They're called the Shanghai Jing. In the fourth book, entitled The Classic of the Eastern Mountains, at least four expeditions to North America are described. The Grand Canyon, the Great Lakes, the Mississippi River, all of these are mentioned in these volumes. In 1972, Hendon M. Harris, a third-generation missionary, found some copies of ancient maps in a Korean antique shop, and he immediately located Fusang, which is the Chinese term for America, and recognized the map's connection to the Shanghai Jing. At the time of his death in 1981, Dr. Harris was aware of 23 similar maps in collections around the world, although their date of origin is unknown. The book History of Cartography indicates that 72% of the place names were congruent with the Shanghai Jing. This indicates that these maps could date back to 2200 BC. So, the question, the statement Columbus discovered America, you could say is true, but it's true in what context is it true? It's true in the context of what I would call modern European history. And an astute student should pick that up anyway. Because if Columbus discovered America, why were there people here when he came? I don't know why teachers don't ask some of those kinds of questions. So it's not that we forget about Columbus or pretend like he never did that or has nothing to do with European history, but that it should be told in its proper context. We should also remember that Columbus didn't discover America. He landed on a Caribbean island. As far as I know, he never touched on the mainland of America at all. And so why have historians chosen as Columbus as such a significant figure? And if we ask those types of questions, we're better able to process that kind of information and share those facts with our students in a meaningful way. It's because Columbus symbolizes a movement that was going on in European history. And historians cannot share every life and how it was connected and how it led up to something, so they choose symbolic points or people to help us understand what's going on. And it's the same thing about those eras of history where we call the Dark Ages, which is actually, that's a whole other one just like this. You shouldn't really call it the Dark Ages. But anyway, the Middle Ages and so forth. Do you think that the people fell asleep one night and they were living in the Middle Ages and then they woke up the next morning and they happened to be in the Renaissance or something? It doesn't happen that way. So our facts have to be told in context. And incidentally, I have another thing here I'm going to refer to later, in which he says that any historian knows, any scholar knows, that basically nobody believed the Earth was flat in Columbus' time. The ancient Greeks had already figured out the size of the Earth and the fact that it was a globe. And if you look at the maps of Columbus' time, almost all of them had reference to a globe-type structure. And so the whole beautiful story about everyone believing the Earth was flat and then changing a globe, unfortunately, isn't true. Another aspect of this whole thing, this European thing, is some of the other questions that we come up with in history, some of the other things we touch on, like around the same time period, like the caravel. Where did that come from? Oh, the Europeans, the Portuguese developed it as part of a wonderful ship discovery that helped them. Really? As far as historians know, Europeans picked up the plans for the caravel from the Africans who got it from the Phoenicians. It had been around for a long time. That's an interesting connection. What do the Phoenicians know about seagoing? I think your students would probably love that little fact, but it kind of gets brushed over in not really putting things in context. How about some other things? Maybe in American history, Benedict Arnold. Wow, who is that man? Does anybody know the kind of the feeling around Benedict Arnold? Yes.
A great traitor.
He's a horrible traitor, right? So why is there a monument celebrating Benedict Arnold up in New England? That's exactly right. A famous war hero, right? We got a huge image of Benedict Arnold's boot, I think it is. Anyway, okay, how about flight? Students, at least boys, love this. Airplanes, all of that. The Wright brothers, they were the first to invent a working aircraft. That's wonderful. Americans, too. Wow. There is a sense in which that's true. And I think it's fine that we emphasize it. It really is the beginning of the age of flight. But there's a sense in which it's false. Does anyone know? Who, as far as historians know, actually invented the first working aircraft? Not Leonardo da Vinci. Again? Okay. The ancient Chinese. Chinese have documents written history, diagrams of a working aircraft that a man developed hundreds of years before the Europeans even thought of any such thing as developing aircraft. And they say that he actually flew in it, and successfully, and possibly even further than the Wright brothers did on their first flight. Well then, why don't the Chinese have a whole bunch of jets flying around about the time Columbus is hopping into his ship? Chinese emperor was smart. Said, we won't have any more of that nonsense, and he executed the man. But there's some context. Let's keep going. Students, it's important to drink 8 8-ounce glasses of water a day if you want to be healthy. They're like, wow, we haven't been drinking enough. That's right. Measure it, water. Okay. Well, we need water to live. That's true. It never occurred to you that if you have to drink 8 8-ounce glasses of water a day to live, what happened to the people before we knew that? Did they die off for lack of water? Is there a mechanism in your body that really regulates the amount of water you need and just kind of tells you when you don't have enough water? Or is it this little theory true that if you're thirsty, it's too late? Well, it's fascinating because this idea was popularized by the USDA, I believe, who commissioned a study on the nutrition needs and so forth of humans. And they said that the amount of water that a person requires for optimal health is approximately equal to 8 8-ounce glasses of water a day. Actually, they didn't say that. They put it in actual ounces, like 65 ounces of water a day. And that included all the food that you ate, all the fruit, all the, you know, everything. That was the total amount of moisture that they considered probably necessary for optimal health. Someone, maybe a news reporter, who knows, wanted to give that the personal twist, so he converted the ounce amount to glasses of water. That's much more personable. We can all handle that. The problem is that in the process, all that about the moisture in your food kind of got swept under the rug. And so then you had people saying that besides what you eat, and some people then going saying, besides the coffee that you drink and the soda that you drink and the juice that you drink, you also need 8 8-ounce glasses of water a day. Well, that's only true if you live in Florida in August. I mean, it's not really the case. Here's a couple of fancy ones that come up recently. Is it really true that eating chocolate will make you healthy and drinking wine will make you healthy? I don't know how many news articles I've seen about the benefits of chocolate and drinking wine. Just bring that, you know, human interest, bring it in your classroom. Did you know, students, that you eat chocolate, you'll be healthy? Students will like that one. I think that's why it gets out in the news so much. Oh, great. Chocolate and wine. All right.
And all the antioxidants in coffee.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, what's the truth about it? When you actually go back and look at the scientific studies, what are the facts? Okay. There's a certain amount of nutritional value in dark, unsweetened, unfattened cocoa. 1 ounce a day will get you a certain amount of nutrients. Okay. Is anyone eating dark, unsweetened, unfattened cocoa? And couldn't you get the nutrients another way? Well, yeah, that's true too. Sounds so good, right? It's just kind of told out of context. What about the wine? Oh, maybe some of us who've, you know, been abstaining from alcoholic beverages need this in order to protect our hearts, right? The actual nutrient qualities are found in the skin of the grape. They're also found in other fruits and vegetables. Grape juice provides as much or more than wine, but it's also found in wine. It is. Okay. So nobody's lying here. It's just that the facts are being told out of context. Well, let's move on. The third aspect of this is that textbooks themselves can actually be wrong. I hope you all know that. It just happens. Textbooks, it's embarrassing. I wish they wouldn't be, but they are, and answer keys can be wrong. Here's one. It's just been puzzling me a lot over the last couple of years. I teach the God's World History from CLE, and I have two different editions in my class. I didn't even know it. One is 1976 and one is 1996. In the 1976 edition, we have this word tufa. It's in reference to some rocks found around Rome close to the... the word slips my mind, the caves where the catacombs, right. And this happens to be on one of my quiz sheets. And I insist that my students spell correctly. And some of my students spell it with two Fs and some spell it with one. And I was telling my students, you need to correct this. And they said, correct what? That's exactly what the book says. And I said, it is not. I pulled out my teacher's volume and I turned to that page. And I said, it has two Fs. Well, I did just look at the student edition. It had one F. So I said, what is going on here and who's right? So I did some research. I pulled it up on my Encarta English Dictionary. And it said, tufa, one F, a porous rock formed from deposited calcium carbonate and found near mineral springs. Tuff, a rock made up of very small volcanic fragments compacted together. I said, well, okay, so if it's the one syllable, it has two Fs. If it's two syllables, it has one F. So I said, I'm going to look it up further. So I went on to dictionary.com, and it said tufa, tufa, one F, in non-technical use. Oh, so it wasn't really a whole lot clearer, but I realized that there's some variety available here, and I don't even know if the textbook publisher used the right word, but anyway, yeah, who knows? I just realized I shouldn't be making such a point of it, and at least one of the textbooks has got to be wrong. We run into those kind of things. I want to share with you some thoughts from this article on scholarly legends. I shared this morning about Luther and the drinking song, how he got this from the bar. That's one of the things here. He also talks about another scholarly legend that arose among, it's stated like this. Did you know that medieval Catholic theologians wasted their time by debating how many angels could dance on the head of a pin? I don't know if any of you have ever heard that before, but I've heard it. It really has kind of a ring to it. He says it never happened. Mortimer Adler researched the contention and found that it was a lampoon of medieval scholasticism that was not meant to be taken literally. Those theologians are so picky that they would debate how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, something like that, kind of sarcastic. The would became did, sort of in the scholarly equivalent of the children's game of telephone, like whispering down the line. It became medieval theologians did debate about how many angels can dance and so forth. Perhaps, touches on one I mentioned earlier, the most common of scholarly legends is the view that in the Middle Ages, people believed that the earth was flat until Columbus proved them wrong. Not true. As anyone who reads any medieval literature from Boethius to Dante, or who looks at any medieval art from cathedral carvings to illuminated manuscripts could attest, the earth is always portrayed and described as a globe. And he talks about the ancient Greeks and how they did that and so forth. And then he closes with this. This is related to the scholarly legend that confuses the Dark Ages, which is actually the barbarian invasion that happened right as the Roman Empire was falling, with the Middle Ages, or as the Enlightenment thinkers were considerate, any time before their Age of Reason. Well, see, then we have this kind of debate, you know, they think that since they didn't understand what we do in the Age of Reason, maybe they were dark, but technically it only applies to the fall of the Roman Empire. Anyway, so much for that. Let's go on to our next point here, which is that, quite frankly, after we've done all this sorting and thinking about facts and their context and which ones we should teach and what's important and all of that, facts just aren't enough. That's disappointing. We love teaching facts and having students recall them, but facts aren't enough. I don't know how many of you have ever heard of Dr. Richard Feynman. He was a famous physicist who had some breakthrough that's probably beyond my comprehension. He would enjoy things like staying up all night figuring out mathematical equations, and he would write. He wrote this one, I think, in particular. He worked it out on a napkin when he was at a diner somewhere, and it was a breakthrough mathematical equation among all mathematicians. And he won these big awards as a physicist. He won the Nobel Prize, and became quite famous. And because of the emphasis in American circles on education in science and math, you probably remember that time when the space race was on and we were just so scared the Soviets were ahead of us, and they were like saying, we just need to put more pressure on science and math, and we even hear that today. So they said, well, you know, how do you do this? Well, let's call in this Nobel Prize winner scientist and get some help from him. So they wanted him to be involved in education. One of the funny things was that he was involved. He was on the Board of Education in California. And he said that they came to a meeting about what textbooks would be used that year. And he said, well, let's have a look at them. Where are they? And they were like, oh, no, we never have any textbooks actually at the meeting. We don't look at the textbooks, you know. We just decide which textbooks we're going to have. And he was like, what? You have to look at a textbook before you decide whether it's scientifically accurate or not. So he said, I want to see every textbook that's under consideration. And they said, okay, well, if you insist. So they delivered a pallet load of textbooks to his personal residence. And he had them moved into the basement, which was his personal domain. And he said his wife called it the volcanic era of their marriage, because he would be quietly down there and he would be going through a science textbook, and all of a sudden there'd be this loud yell and this book would hit the ceiling. It's like, boom! He had found another textbook that was complete garbage as far as presenting true scientific facts. He said he even opened a couple of the textbooks and it was nothing but blank pages from some of the major textbook publishers. And he contacted the representative and said, you call this an entry into which textbook the state of California is going to use this year? There's nothing in it. And they said, oh, yeah, that's okay. It's just a dummy copy because we're still working on what's actually going to be in the textbook. We'll develop that later, but you know, we knew you all had the meeting, so we produced a textbook. So he was like, well, how do they decide what textbooks to use? What are the other people on this committee doing? And he found out that they were having dinner with representatives from these places, and they were receiving gifts at their home and so forth. And all of a sudden, his doorbell started ringing, and people came with chocolates and free airline tickets and invitations to dinner, and he turned them all down. Well, he was very frustrated with that. He was then called by Brazil to come down and analyze the science at their colleges. And so he traveled to Brazil, and they were very proud of what they were doing in science. And he gives an example of the kind of thing he ran into. He said he just walked around the halls of the universities, and he conversed with the students, and he sat in on classes, and he tried to get an idea of what was going on with the science. And he said something like this was just a representative example of what happened constantly. He would ask a student, so what do you know about refraction? And these are college-level students, right? And he said that these students would immediately have an answer. They would say something like this. Refraction is the change in direction that occurs when a wave of energy, such as light, passes from one medium to another of a different density. They knew it. You could ask another student, and they have the same recall. So he would say, well, give me an example of refraction. How would you refract? You know, what kind of things would you use to demonstrate? And they went, no idea. Clueless. Doesn't make any difference to me. I memorized that paragraph from the textbook because I want to be a good student. I want to pass, and we have a lot of pressure on science here. And he told the administrators, you're not teaching science. Your students can memorize every fact in that textbook. They'll know nothing about science, and they'll never be scientists, and your nation isn't going to move forward with this kind of learning. Get in there and get a simple prism set up, and those students will know more about refraction than they ever knew from memorizing paragraphs in the textbook. Facts are not enough. Critical thinking and use of facts must be coupled with fact retention. You know the facts. the math facts, that is, can you solve the story problem? You know, that's a perennial problem for middle school students. 7 times 6, 42. 9 times 3, 27. Sarah had 5 sheep, and she sold 2 of them. And then today she bought 3 more. So how many does she have? And they're like, teacher, I don't know how to do this. Well, why not? It's just simple addition and subtraction. And the only fact of the matter is it's taking place kind of in real life. So we have a disconnect between drill of the facts and ability to think. And we think that we teach facts, that's good enough. All you need to know is the facts. Look, we need to teach how to think. It is something that is taught. It's just not something they just pick up on their own if you keep drilling enough facts into their head. You have to teach them how to think. You know the grammar definitions, right? So students, recite, recite, recite. I'm not against that. They do need to memorize facts. Can you find an adverb in sentence?
Well, I don't know.
Man, is that an adverb? Oh, we have some work to do. Okay, students, Bernoulli's principle. What is it? Oh, that has to do with airflow and creation of vacuum by faster movement of fluids, right? Can you demonstrate it? Yeah, I think so. In class, my teacher had us blow over strips of paper and it lifted up. So that's Bernoulli's principle. Okay, how is it applied in real life? The textbook said that it lifts airplanes up into the air. Okay, great. So far, so good. Now, this is a little more complicated example of what I'm talking about. Because that's good. And we've actually made some progress with our students. They've gone beyond. They haven't just memorized. Okay, first victory, they knew what Bernoulli's principle was. Okay, good. They got that. Okay, they can recite it from the textbook. That's good. We're really making progress. They actually know a demonstration of how it works. Good, good. They know an application of at least how the textbook said it applies. All right. I think that with this level of proficiency, we might be kind of satisfied. What I would like to see is students who go beyond that. And maybe not every student can, but as a teacher, can you model, can you help your students think beyond that? Because what's actually happening is everything they have told you is just things that they picked up from what you have told them. They haven't processed anything in their own head. When you went through and taught that, did you ever have a student say, Bernoulli's principle, faster movement of fluids, lift, curvature of the wing? Teacher, how does that apply to paper airplanes? You just kind of sit there for a moment and you're like, well, I don't know. Paper airplanes don't have curved wings, do they? Well, how do they fly? Bernoulli's principle? I have a wooden airplane at home, put together out of balsa wood, and I noticed all the wings are perfectly flat. Oh, yeah. I was researching the Wright brothers, you know, anyway, that goes way too far. But the fact of the matter is, a critical thinker can think beyond what they've been fed, and they can begin to process those things and apply them to real life. And that is a good thing. Teachers actually don't like that. That feels very uncomfortable because they're bound to catch you out. Because you're just in that groove teaching the textbook. You yourself have been maybe so busy that you haven't been involved in a lot of critical thinking, and you have a student come to you and say something like that, and you're like, let someone else answer the question, you know. We don't have time to talk about that right now. But it's a valid question. Actually, that debate that I shared with you comes from a debate that took place at one textbook publisher who was trying to decide how they should present Bernoulli's principle and whether it actually has to do with lift and aircraft. Now, I kind of find it unfortunate that they decided the best thing to do was to just go with the traditional move and say, well, they don't want to contradict anybody else's textbooks, so they said that it provides lift and aircraft. The fact of the matter is it does not. The lift that Bernoulli's principle applies for aircraft is minimal, makes very little difference. The most important thing about it in aircraft is that it simplifies airflow and reduces wind current conflicts, so the airplane is actually more efficient with a curved wing. It doesn't have to do with how it goes up in the air or goes down. But thinking minds is what we need. We really need, okay, we need a solid foundation, we need truth, we need to understand how it works, but we need people who can use facts wisely. We raise a generation of young people who know it all, but they don't have this component. It's a hollow generation. They won't be able to deal with what they face. So we need to move beyond facts to applying facts, usefulness of facts, and able to critically think about facts. We're going to have to close here. There is so much that can be said about facts. I mean, obviously there is. Maybe some of you have some very specific questions or problems or things that you hope we could have covered here about facts, and you've been wrestling with facts. So I just want to close down my part of what I have to say, and I want to listen to you if you have questions or thoughts or comments or something to share here in these few minutes now. So I'm going to just open it up. And also feel free if you need to move off to go right ahead. Yes?
I'd like to hear your take on all the dietary and nutrition in those facts.
I could probably do a week-long series on health scams and nutritional falsehoods. And the problem here is very basic. Actually, it's a two-part problem. One is that we are ignorant. Did you ever hear the little idea that you feel ill and out of place because your organs have fallen out of place? Oh, they actually make a machine you can buy that will hang you upside down and put your organs back into place.
Where do they sell
them? It only costs a couple hundred dollars. Why would anyone believe that? Well, they believe that, first of all, because they've never been taught to think critically. Mm-hmm. If you're not taught to think critically, you can have two contradictory ideas in your mind, and you never even know they contradict one another. You just accept both of them. So that's really problem number one. Problem number two is we are just ignorant. If you ever dissected a pig in biology class, you realize there's nowhere for your organs to go. They are very well placed right where they belong, and as a matter of fact, they have tissue that tacks them in place. If your organs are slopping around in your body, there's something seriously wrong with you. So that's the kind of things we deal with, and I think we need to pick up those things in biology class. I think we need to spend more time on biology, including how the human body works, so that we're not as tempted to swallow these kinds of weird ideas. This is where I think the high school level becomes very important. Chemistry, what about it? Is it possible to ionize water in such a way that it becomes healthier or more liquid or something like that? In chemistry class, you find out it's absolutely impossible. You cannot do to water to what they say they're doing to water. Mm. So what are they doing with those machines?
Making money.
There was a man who developed a wave machine that was supposed to use radio waves to test your nutrient levels, I think is what it was. And it had a little readout or something. I don't know exactly how it was, but anyway, you use that. And it was introduced at the time when radar and radio waves, I guess I should say, were just becoming popular. It was like the latest scientific craze, right? So everything with that name sounds, wow, high tech, right? And various researchers and scientists wanted to open his device and see what was in there. And he said, no, it's proprietary, it's copyrighted and patented, and you can't open it. So they didn't. And he sold thousands of these things, and he made a mint on them. And then he died. And some research organization collected them and opened them up. And they were triangles of metal. And they were full of a small scoop of junk that he had just gotten from the local who knows what and just dumped it in there and welded it shut. And it had no ability to produce radio waves and had no ability to read radio waves. It had nothing to do with radio waves. It wasn't complex at all. It was just a very, very simple heap of junk. But the list of people who said that they had been healed by it was long. And the list of people who said they'd been helped by it was long. And there were lots of sworn testimonies of people who strongly believed it. Well, see, that's a whole nother week of how the human psychology works and how it influences our health and so forth. Anyway, I shouldn't speak too long. I'll speak too much on that. Anything else? Yes?
When you start reading into, especially like popular history stories and stuff, you sometimes find out that they're not necessarily maybe exactly the way they are normally presented. For instance, Stonewall Jackson, where he got his name and so on, I read like there's like four or five different explanations for where mm-hmm. that came from. Where, mm-hmm. and then you start reading that maybe Martin Luther didn't actually tack the 95 Theses onto the door and so on.
Right.
So like how far do you tell the stories to students? Do you look into each one of them to figure out if they're mm-hmm. actually true or not? Mm-hmm.
Several points here. First of all, don't forget that modern historians have just as much of an agenda as the old historians did. Their idea in supposedly showing off their critical thinking abilities is to tear apart history and make it to look as ridiculous as possible. So we got everything in context. We got to realize where that's coming from. Secondly, you'll find out that, and I think students should know this, and I wish our history curriculums could present it better, history is compiled from just a collections of things you come across. I mean, this is family letters, this is diaries people have kept, this is archaeological evidence. We're piecing it together from all over. It's not like I just, well, I was going into the British Library and I found this volume that said History of the World and I just, you know, read it. It's not that. Right? You got to understand that. And so I present these stories, especially ones that cannot, both of the examples you gave, they cannot be proved wrong. It's possible that both of those things are true. Now, some historians say it's unlikely that Luther actually tacked it up, but nobody can actually say he didn't tack it up, and some still think that it's possible he could have tacked it up. So I still share those stories, but I let my students know that we don't know for sure, okay? It's possible that Luther actually went and tacked that up there, and certainly these articles were very foundational in kind of the Reformation movement and so forth, but frankly, students, we don't know for sure. That's kind of how history is. And so I think just by giving that disclaimer, they kind of have the understanding that that's kind of how history works. There's a lot of things we don't know for sure, so that's kind of, yes?
In current events, world events, especially American interests, I've found it to be very helpful to get papers from other countries,
mm-hmm.
From Canada, mm-hmm. which doesn't necessarily mean I'll go by what they're saying,
mm-hmm.
but it's just they're you said, they have an agenda as well,
mm-hmm.
but you compare what they're saying mm-hmm. or how they're viewing what is going on in American events, current events, to what we're reading,
mm-hmm.
It helps round it out.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another one. How many of you have heard this? Luke 18, verse 24. And when Jesus saw that, he became very sorrowful. He said, "How hard it is for those who have riches to enter the kingdom of God. For it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God." Now, there's a very popular story out that in ancient times,
yes.
You know the story
about
the
tiny
needle's
gate.
Eye gate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I've heard that I don't know how many times over the pulpit. There is a very well-respected authority on Jewish history and the life in the time of Jesus, and he uses the story, but do the research. I had a student challenge me on this one. Well, he said, I don't read that. I don't see that. It doesn't say a gate. It says through the eye of a needle.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Okay, well, what's the Bible dictionary say? Oh, this one says that's what it is. It says in ancient times you have this gate. Well, what's another dictionary say here? And you do the research, and you this picture, suddenly you start realizing, oh, this first heard maybe, 100 years ago, some American evangelist maybe came up with this idea.
Mm-hmm.
That, and how did it start? We don't know, but possibly trying to explain to someone that, but
rich people can make it to heaven.
Yeah.
It's just hard.
It's just hard. You can do it. But what they fail is that, but he said, the things which are impossible with men are possible with God.
Mm-hmm.
And so critical thinking is essential.
It's key. Two very important points from what you just shared. One is that check multiple sources, because it's hard to get the full perspective from just one source. If it's something important, if you're interested in really getting the facts on something, check multiple sources. But the second point, which I have found extremely critical, and I think we do not wrestle with nearly enough, is that today, in today's educational climate and culture, you're going to find lots of sources that still aren't the facts. Today, scholars reference each other. You go to that bibliography list, you go to those footnotes, and you're like, it must be right. He's got 2 pages of footnotes here. And then you go look, and you look them all up, and you find out all he's doing is citing another professor who says the same thing he says. Go back, if at all possible, in every case, especially if it's critical, see if you can find source something, a source document, a source science study. Because when you get back there, I do not know what is wrong with our world today, because if you look at these things, a common person with a nose on their face and 2 eyes in their head can see what the truth is. But we have a huge body of published material that doesn't even care about that. All they care about is that they're along with the popular opinion and they're cross-referencing each other. That's a whole other big topic in themselves, but I think teachers need to be aware of that. Go to source materials if at all you can. Some schools have actually shifted to teaching only from source materials instead of pre-chewed information. When they teach history, they actually look at those documents and copies of those documents, and they send you on the web where you can read letters written by people who lived in that time, and you can get the source material. It doesn't hurt to feed that in. It is time to move along if you want to. Go ahead.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.